Have you ever been to the doctor and heard him or her say, you really need to lose some weight? A lot of us do need to lose. We know we need to lose. But how? It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Dr. Lawrence Apple is the director of the Welch Center for Prevention, Epidemiology, and Clinical Research at Johns Hopkins University. He has conducted weight loss trials to try to find the best and most efficient way for doctors to help their patients lose weight. I'll talk with him today about what he has discovered through his practice-based opportunities for weight reduction or power trials and what this means for doctors and patients. Join our conversation after the news. This is an archive edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With obesity reaching epidemic proportions in the United States, many of us know that we need to lose weight. Many of us have been told by our doctors that we need to lose weight. Knowing and being told that we need to lose weight doesn't really do anyone a lot of good. The challenge of weight loss can sometimes seem impossible. And even doctors have felt helpless in the face of it. My guest today has done research that is empowering doctors and making it possible for people with serious health problems to lose weight effectively. Dr. Lawrence Apple is the director of the Welch Center for Prevention, Epidemiology, and Clinical Research at the Johns Hopkins University. He's visiting the University of Iowa Obesity Initiative today in Iowa City. Dr. Apple, thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Most of us don't really think about weight loss recommendations from the perspective of the doctor. We think about us being the ones sitting there on the table on the crinkly paper and hearing uncomfortable news that, you know, you really need to lose 30 pounds or more. From a doctor's perspective, how has it felt historically to tell a patient that you know needs to lose weight that they need to lose
Sure.
weight?
Yeah, it's very common for patients to see physicians and get advice on weight loss. And most physicians are actually very positive about weight loss, but also very frustrated that they don't have the right tools to accomplish it. And in large part, it's because the setting is not particularly correct. Patients come with other medical problems that take time, and physicians themselves haven't been trained to implement behavioral type of interventions. And a third and really important issue is that behavioral interventions that and that's the term that I use for helping patients lose weight typically require frequent repeated contact. And so when I do a study, I typically have a coach provide counseling on a weekly basis. And that's not how patients see physicians. They might see physicians once every 2 to 3 months if they're stable. So it's extraordinarily uncommon to say, well, come in once a week for counseling. And furthermore, reimbursement system doesn't pay for it. So you have this disconnect between patients wanting to lose weight and physicians who want to do something but really don't have the tools to do it.
Is there also a problem for physicians when patients come to see the doctor, often they have something wrong with them? This is not someone who is a few pounds overweight who might develop problems usually. This is somebody who is already experiencing problems,
sure.
Right?
Yeah, so you're right on target. So patients typically come with one or more medical problems. There is the occasional patient who's healthy and just wants a physical examination. But most people who are middle and older age have at least one, you know, medical condition. Maybe it's hypertension, diabetes, arthritis. Now, these are also happen to be weight-related. So the doctor is, you know, often in a position, well, I can treat your arthritis by giving you a pill for pain relief. I can lower your blood pressure with antihypertensive medication. But that doesn't get at the root cause of the problem, which might be weight. And so it's, again, you're trying to squeeze it in an interview in which a patient visit in which the contact really is structured to do something else, not weight loss.
Do you think that there have been times that doctors have actually steered clear of the weight loss conversation because they don't have anything to offer?
You know, the weight loss conversation is actually pretty complex when you think about it. You know, it's also at a very basic level, when somebody is overweight, just if the person is interested in losing weight, that's great. But if you're talking about somebody and with labels as some that some might believe are pejorative, like you're obese, let's talk about your obesity. So there's even a problem with the dialogue that physicians have some struggle with, you know, discussing obesity in the context of trying to maintain a good relationship with a patient. You use these terms that might be offensive.
Well, sure. I mean, I can imagine if we just think about in our own world, if you were talking to someone who you know has a weight problem, although, you know, obviously it's not your business to tell them that they need to lose weight, how incredibly difficult that would be to do. And it's hard for the doctor, too, because they are people and this is a personal interaction.
Sure. And it's even hard, you know, another level you didn't mention, though, is just even with children, you know, parents. Right now we have a fairly common situation in which parents have overweight children. How do you discuss weight with children? And many parents aren't particularly equipped with that. And I've even, you know, had conversations with colleagues who are experts in obesity, and they say they struggle with talking to their children about, you know, about weight control. Yeah.
So the clinical trials that you ran, we'll get into sort of the nuts and bolts of what you did, but where did the genesis come from? What did you see and your colleagues see as the need for coming up with some sort of clinical way to deal with weight loss?
Yeah. So as I said before, it's a common medical problem, and yet physicians didn't really have a tool. So there was a need for it, and yet very little evidence. In fact, there were some systematic reviews that were done around the time that we started the clinical trial, and there were like a total of 10 studies. All of them had some sort of design issues. Most often it was a very brief intervention, and we know from our other studies that you really do need to have frequent contact. A second issue is that there was incomplete follow-up, which gives biased results. And so the database that supported any particular treatment was pretty lacking. And so in this context, the National Institutes of Health, which is the part of the federal government that funds medical research, said, you know, we need to put money into investigating strategies that could help physicians promote weight loss. So what they did, it was around 2005, there was a request for applications, and we were one of the three clinical trials that got funded to test two interventions in our particular study.
So these are called the practice-based opportunities for weight reduction trials, the POWER trials. You tested two different kinds of weight loss. Tell me about the structure of the trial. You had three different groups, right?
Right. So this was a clinical trial, meaning that individuals had to be willing to be randomized, assigned, you know, by chance to one of three different groups. One group was a self-directed arm where they were given very brief advice, list of websites, and they were basically on their own to lose weight.
So this is kind of the traditional approach that many physicians have had to take over the years.
That's what you could say. You could call it usual care. Okay. So that was one group. And the second group was similar to what we had done in trials that had not been focused on patients were just general population. So this is a combination of group sessions where people would come to us. They would get counseling in a group. There would be support from others and potentially some bonding, along with individual counseling, some telephone contact. So that was the second group. And then the third group got telephone counseling, okay? And by that, we mean there was absolutely no face-to-face contact with the coach. It was done remotely. Now, we also realized that we had to be practical and try to reinforce the messages from from the coaches. So we had a website in which people entered their weight, tracked their weight, and if they didn't, they got reminders to do that. They also, on the website, were able to get information about weight loss, you know, counting calories, how to, you know, also behavioral tools, like what are you going to do when Thanksgiving occurs and you're going to have five desserts? How are you going to, you know, that kind of. And then there was the third piece that the participants got, which was periodic support from their physician. We thought that physicians themselves, while they're eager to promote weight loss, they're really not in a position to provide that frequent counseling. And so we said, well, but they should be sort of like a cheerleader type of role, and that's what the physicians did. So if an individual like yourself were to enroll, be assigned randomly to that remote counseling, they would have gotten almost weekly counseling over the phone for the first 3 months and then monthly thereafter. But for every week, they were expected to weigh themselves and put that number on the website so that there would be a graph that shows where their weight was in relation to their starting point as well as the target weight.
And who could see that?
Well, the patient could see that, but also the coach. And that was what was very – it turned out to be pretty unique because a lot of the counseling that has been done previously over the phone, the time was spent in gathering information. Can you tell me what your weight is? And can you tell me whether you exercise or not? And all this information actually was on the website. And so the coach could see it. And so the conversation started with the behaviors, not with gathering and or wasting time collecting information. So the coaches really thought that this was a very effective part of the intervention.
And when they had those telephone interactions with their coaches, is it the same coach every time? Are they assigned one person?
Right. That's very important. There's a bonding experience that occurs with between a client and a coach. And previously, companies had just done sort of random dialing to, reach somebody, and it's not particularly effective. Participants, part of weight loss is actually dealing with the problems that emerge, and some of them they're not easily scripted. For example, we started this study before there was the economic downturn, so we had participants that lost jobs, lost homes, stuff like that. And so, how do you sort of still promote a healthy lifestyle when somebody is dealing with a very, very serious, problem that is sort of interferes with desirable behaviors?
Who were these coaches? What kind of qualifications did they have?
Well, it was interesting. the research was, it was primarily supported by NIH. We got support from a disease management company called Healthways, which provided the coaches for the telephone intervention. And Healthways also prepared the website. So we were assigned they gave us two coaches who had some training in health education and coaching, but they actually had never previously done weight loss. So these were pretty green when it comes to the program that we were trying to implement. And so that's actually a very important feature, is that we really didn't cherry pick the coaches to get like high level PhD types that might be deemed in when you look at the studies to be not something you could replicate.
Right, right.
So these are people that had some basic counseling skills, but not anything
specialized expertise.
Right.
Really. I'm talking with Dr. Lawrence Apple. He's the director of the Welch Center for Prevention, Epidemiology, and Clinical Research at Johns Hopkins University. We're talking about clinical trials that he has done on weight loss that give doctors and patients a way to approach the problem. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. You're listening to an archive edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Dr. Lawrence Apple. He's the director of the Welch Center for Prevention, Epidemiology, and Clinical Research at Johns Hopkins University. He's visiting the University of Iowa Obesity Initiative today in Iowa City. And before the break, we were talking about the trials that you conducted on weight loss, practice-based opportunities for weight reduction or power trials. You had three groups, a control group where the patient met with the doctor briefly and got information and a website they could refer to. And then you had two other groups, and one where they had face-to-face contact, one where they had remote contact with coaches to help them with their weight loss. How long did the study run?
The clinical trial lasted 2 years. That's the point from when the person got assigned to their group to the last point at which we collected weight. So it was also longer than most of the other studies that had assessed the physician-based weight loss.
And I failed to ask you, the people who qualified to be a part of this study, was there a certain amount of weight that they needed to have to lose?
So they had to have be obese, which is defined as a body mass index greater than 30. So these are people who are – nobody would disagree that they, you know, had weight to lose. And they also had to have a cardiovascular risk factor related to weight. So they had to have at least one of the following three, hypertension, high cholesterol, or diabetes. So everybody – and everybody had to be in one of the practices that – or medical practices that was participating in the study. So we had about six medical practices, and we recruited through those practices to get our participants.
And how many participants did you have?
Just over 400. So there was about roughly 130 in 30 and plus change in each of the three groups that I mentioned.
And did you mark progress along the way? Did you look at weight loss after a year, weight loss after 2 years?
Sure. So the way the study was conducted, we collected weight at baseline, then at 6 months after the start, and then 12 months after the start, and then 24 months. So we had three follow-up points. And the other thing about our study is that we got incredibly high follow-up rates, meaning that we had – there was no sort of cherry-picking of the results at the end. The only people you report are the people who lost weight, which is a common problem in weight loss studies. So we got almost 100% follow-up. And I didn't mention – so the average weight loss in the two groups, the groups that got the remote counseling and the group that had the in-person counseling, the weight loss was roughly 5 kilograms or 5% on average at both points in time. And that was important. It wasn't just that you got the weight loss in 6 months, but it persisted over the two-year period.
So they were able to lose weight and keep the weight off.
It was a modest amount of weight loss, but it was sustained, which is different from some of our other studies where the typical pattern, and many people can appreciate it, is that you lose weight and then there's regain. And there are many possible reasons for that. Some people think it might be just biology. I think there's a good behavioral part to it where people lose weight and then the counseling frequency – lose weight by 6 months and then the counseling frequency often decreases from weekly to monthly at that point. But that's when you actually need to have the continued contact, and that's where the website I think was useful, because when a participant was in each of the active arms, they had to go to the website and insert their weight and maybe their physical activity on a weekly basis. And if they didn't, they were reminded to do that. And it was also so there was what I'll call continued intervention, even though there wasn't face to face contact as frequently as at the early end. And I think that really was helpful in sustaining a weight loss effect over time.
So you said that the weight loss in the two groups that had contact, that had coaching, was roughly the same?
Yeah, yeah.
And one of those groups had this face-to-face interaction. The other group did not have the face-to-face interaction.
Right, right.
So you found that the face-to-face interaction really didn't make a difference?
On average, it didn't. No, I mean the lines are perfectly overlapping. If you know, this was probably one of the most intriguing findings, because almost all of the other studies that I had done were face-to-face, and there, it's cumbersome for people.
And expensive.
It's expensive. You have to have space. And the space typically is only used at night, you know. And you have to, you know, have somebody to open the door. And so it's really quite cumbersome, not just for us in providing a weight loss intervention, but it's also cumbersome for participants, because they have to get in their car. They have to make sure that they're available those times, which is not always convenient. You know, schedules change. And so the logistics of doing in-person counseling at the same time week after week is really quite daunting. And so what we showed was, well, you know, you can have this – you don't really need to have that group experience. You can call people up. You can schedule at times that are convenient. You can change times. You can rearrange. And you'll get, in the end, the same effect as if you were to have a more traditional program that was, you know, based on face-to-face contact.
You mentioned the amount of weight loss. You said 5 kilograms, so a little over 10 pounds?
Right, yeah. So it was around 11, 12 pounds, you know, on average at the end. And about just around 40% of people lost 5% or more. So there are some people that, you know, lost substantial amounts of weight. And I'll confess there are also people that you know, where it didn't work and they gained weight. In general, though, our program is no different from others, you know, in that if you participate, you tend to lose weight. And probably one of the biggest predictors of whether somebody, you know, doesn't lose weight is they sort of drop out early. They don't participate in the telephone calls, or they don't log in. So that happens in almost every weight loss program. But that average effect that I told you, that 5%, is across everybody that starts. And again, wasn't involving cherry picking.
Well, and you mentioned that the people in the study were 30 or more pounds, or 30. They had a body mass index of 30.
Yeah, that's
or more.
That's difficult for many people to understand. So that would be like maybe a 5'5" person who weighs 200 pounds, something like that.
Okay.
So you'd somebody who would clearly have weight to lose.
When you think about that specific person losing 10 to 12 pounds, that may not seem like that much. How significant is that much weight loss when you look at it in terms of a person's health?
Sure. So as I mentioned, weight is associated with many, many adverse health outcomes: blood pressure, lipids, and diabetes, risk of diabetes. So it's been shown in other studies, not ours, because we really weren't designed to look at the effects of weight loss on these risk factors, that a 5% weight loss will reduce blood pressure, will have favorable effects on blood cholesterol levels and triglyceride levels, and will reduce the risk of type 2 diabetes and improve control. And there were some people that really did very well. They lost a lot of weight, and they were able to come off of some of their medications. Some people were able to get off their diabetes medication. So it was good. It was on average good, and then there's some that, you know, it really
did
was
better.
Did even better, yeah.
And does losing just 10 pounds, does that make that much of a difference? I mean, you talked about some people did extremely well.
Yeah.
But for the person who lost 10 pounds over a period of 2 years, how much of a difference would that make?
Well, you know, for blood pressure, it's probably going to lead to about, you know, 4 or 5 millimeters of mercury, which for some people might represent – certainly from a health public health perspective, it's huge. But from an individual perspective, it might be the difference between increased dose of a medication or addition if the person doesn't have controlled blood pressure. So it's a benefit, but it's not the kind of dramatic 30% reduction that you get from, let's say, bariatric surgery. It's clear that you're going to get much more from that type of intervention. But there's also risk of bariatric surgery, and it's not really applicable to the broad population.
I'm talking with Dr. Lawrence Apple. He's the director of the Welch Center for Prevention, Epidemiology, and Clinical Research at Johns Hopkins University. We're talking about research he's done into how physicians can help their patients lose weight, programs that empower physicians and empower those who need to lose weight. You're welcome to join our conversation as well at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. The number again, 866-780-9100. Have you continued to follow these people? This was a 2-year study. Did that continue on after that?
No, we haven't. There have been a few people that have graciously agreed to interviews like this, it takes a lot of money to do these clinical trials, and the funding ended for the trial actually last June, so we haven't followed them.
Some of the things that you're talking about with the groups that had intervention remind me of some of the things that are commercially available or even available for free right now, like the apps that you can get on your phone to help you lose weight. There's Lose It, there's MyFitnessPal, there are all these different apps that people can get. You can also connect to a social network along with that if you want to, or you can just keep it to yourself. There are a lot of other weight loss websites that sell subscriptions where they can, you know, send you an email and hook you up with a coach or something like that. Do you think that the interventions that you talked about are comparable to those kind of things?
the types of interventions you mentioned, particularly those that are based on web-based applications and iPhone or iPad type apps. They're intriguing, but they haven't been tested. And my gut instinct tells me that they're not going to be as effective. What I think, we've done other studies that, in one study in particular called weight loss maintenance, which was pure internet. It would involve people going to a website, but there was no nudge with a coach. And I think that what you lack with those pure, I'll call them IT type of interventions, is that that synergy that you get with the technology and with some personal coaching. And the question is, like, how much do you need of sort of both? Because clearly the person-to-person coaching takes it's more expensive. It's very interesting because apps are there are a lot of very tech-oriented people. Apps can be made, probably less than a week by smart people. But what I see is a disconnect between the behavioral science needed that underlies the design of these versus just designing an app. So you can get an app that has a lot of interesting features to it, but is it really reinforcing the principles that are going to lead to weight loss? And there's often a disconnect.
Right. Well, and you mentioned cost, and of course that's a big deal for a lot of individuals and a lot of insurance companies.
Sure.
And so with the setup that you had, where there was this contact with coaches and over the telephone and the web presence, how much would that cost, do you think, per year for an individual?
Right. That's a great question. We are preparing a paper on this that goes into a lot of detail. But it probably can be done for over the course of 2 years, about $700 to $800.
Per year or
total,
for the whole 2 years?
Total, yeah. So it's moderate. It's not – and it's actually, I think, consistent with what other programs would be charging for that frequency of contact. But, so it's reasonable. It's certainly less than the in-person, where you have a lot of other sort of capital that's required.
Right. Well, and it seems like the payoff is significant enough that – do you think that that's something that maybe insurance providers might consider in the future, because they're preventing other health problems?
Yeah. Well, that's insurers are under a lot of duress. They need to cover emergency room visits, ICU, hospital stays, and everything else. What we're finding is that there's a lot of interest with employers. Mm-hmm. And so that's where – it's actually a really substantial right now what's going on. I mean, virtually all major employers have decided that prevention is important to their bottom line, and it might reduce their insurance costs downstream. So a lot of employers are providing lifestyle type programs geared towards increasing physical activity, weight loss, improved diet, because they're seeing their costs go through. And it's really interesting. It's actually Johns Hopkins is in that situation too, and they're started to, despite all the pressures of the university to save money, they've actually going to put more money into programs to promote healthy lifestyles in their workforce, and they're actually going to be providing a version of this program to our employees at Hopkins.
All right. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Emily is on the line from Iowa City. Hi, Emily.
Hello.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
Sure. I'm a personal trainer, and I've found that with my clients, it's really challenging for them to make permanent and lasting change when they don't have those social networks that reinforce healthy lifestyle changes, like you were mentioning, the Lose It apps and other apps that are just for counting calories don't tend to encourage them to stick with the program for very long. One thing I found that helps when they don't have those social networks that are encouraging healthy lifestyles is to help them set attainable goals. So I have them rank, from 1 to 10, here's a goal. I want you to drink 10 glasses of water a day. On a scale from 1 to 10, how reasonable do you feel it is for you to keep that goal? And if they're, a 9 or a 10 that they think they can do it, then I say, okay, we'll work on that goal. and or, you know, getting them to move 30 minutes a day or, you know, overhaul their diet. I just take baby steps, and I find that, you know, they feel empowered when they do that, so that, you know, they feel like they're championing something. And also it just, you know, has them on the path for a more healthy lifestyle rather than trying to overhaul everything all in one fell swoop.
Yeah. Well, what you mentioned is really very consistent with our approach. I didn't go into a lot of detail, but the idea of setting goal setting, achievable goals, is really a key, you know, both for physical activity and also for diet. So I know I actually participated in one of our own pilots, and I still do, you know, do the self-monitoring, which is to set, you know, daily goals for physical activity and actually write those out. And then I also write when I complete it. So, you know, if I say, actually, today I wanted to do 20 minutes of physical activity, I got in 15 on a treadmill, and I'm going to write that on my log, my exercise log. And likewise, you can do the same thing, you know, with other types of dietary behaviors, you know, cutting out, let's say, totally cutting out or reducing, you know, certain types of foods like desserts or sodas or something like that. So goal setting, setting expectations, and then tracking, I think, is really very important. Another issue that you brought up that I didn't, which I think is really important, is changing the environment. And some people, we have a limited ability to change our environment. So I can just tell you that I do direct a center, and sometimes I find that the food that is provided as part of the center is not the healthiest food, or that there's too much of it. And so I've actually tried to, where possible, cut back on the food that is provided, not as many breakfasts in the morning, and I think that helps people.
Emily, thanks a lot for your call. My guest is Dr. Lawrence Apple. He's the director of the Welch Center for Prevention, Epidemiology, and Clinical Research at Johns Hopkins University. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Charity Nebbe, and you're listening to an archive edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. My guest today is Dr. Lawrence Apple. He's the director of the Welch Center for Prevention, Epidemiology, and Clinical Research at Johns Hopkins University. He's visiting the University of Iowa Obesity Initiative today in Iowa City. We've been talking about studies that he has done that give physicians a way to help their patients lose weight, as opposed to suggesting that they need to lose weight. This empowers physicians. It also empowers patients as well. And you're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Bryce is on the line from Des Moines. And Bryce, you're doing my job. I failed to ask the question you want to ask, so go ahead and ask it.
Yes, I wanted to ask the doctor, is if you had an uncontrolled group, or the group that just had a little touch and a little advice and that was it, what would you expect the weight gain to be for a group that didn't do anything? Because it would seem to me, if you would expect them over 2 years to gain 10 pounds, they in effect would have saved 20 pounds of weight by going through the program.
Yeah,
that's
interesting.
A pertinent question.
That's a great question. You know, the one thing about clinical trials that's interesting, and it's also highlights the complexity, is that it takes people who are interested in weight loss, and yet they have to be willing to be randomized to a group that doesn't get an active intervention. So we do start off with people who want to lose weight. We actually experienced in our study what has now been experienced in several weight loss studies, is that the control group lost on average a little bit, about 1 kilogram, about 2 pounds. So this has happened in a few studies now, where just that little bit of advice on average gets you something. But your point's well taken. You know, maybe without that there would have been you know gain. It also is, you also have to realize that it started off with a group of people who wanted to lose weight.
Right. Right, there was the intention there in the beginning. Bryce, thank you so much for your question. And Christy is on the line now from Bloomfield. Hello, Christy.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
I have a question for you, doctor. Are some of the same principles that you're learning from this study, do you think they would hold true for childhood obesity? As far as the coaching and...
Or
do you think that's more of a lifestyle change, you know, coaching the parents?
That's a great question, very thought provoking. I while I have children, I don't consider myself an expert in the issues that you raise. I think it would have to be totally retooled. The interface that we dealt with, for example, was a classic sort of website, enter data, show graphs. I'm not sure that that would be very appealing. I think you'd have to have messages and not just messages, but tools for behavior change that are really geared towards a totally different audience. And so I think it might be I think we'd have to totally restructure it.
Well, and of course you're talking about adults here with free will. Kids don't have control necessarily over what they eat or even what they do.
Yeah. So you also have to, you know, their environment is even, you know, more important. It's a great question. There are now several studies that are trying to accomplish weight loss in children. I'm not directly involved with any of them, though.
What kind of diet direction did these patients have that were involved in the program?
I think the key for we did not want to emphasize sort of diet composition as the main feature. We emphasize calorie reduction. So one of the things that the coaches did was to identify, you know, the major source of calories that could be reduced that was probably, you know, often nutrient poor, whether it was, you know, desserts or sodas or just reducing everything. The diet or the type of foods that we did promote would be consistent with what we call the DASH diet, which is what is recommended for general health. It's very rich in fruits and vegetables, low-fat dairy and reduced in fats. It's about like low to mid-50s in terms of the percent carbohydrate. Basically a healthy diet. We wanted to avoid any sort of fringe diet that really could not be sustained long-term, like, you know, something that's, let's say, all grapefruit or something like that.
Right, something that would be a change for a short period of time, but right. Nothing that you could sustain over a long period of time.
Yep.
And the DASH diet that you mentioned, that is something that you were involved in developing, right?
Yeah, that was many years ago. About 15 years ago. And that was what we did was we tested the effects of different dietary patterns on blood pressure and other cardiovascular risk factors. And we found striking reductions in blood pressure when individuals consumed this dietary pattern versus what typical many people, which is low fruits and vegetables and, you know, very little dairy and higher in fat.
We have a question from Facebook. This is from the Iowa Public Health Association, wondering if you can address effective policy changes that have demonstrated to support community-level obesity reduction initiatives. Have you, in your research or in looking at other people's research, are there things that communities can do overall?
Yeah, I have not personally been involved with those type of research efforts. They're much more difficult to design and implement and evaluate because you typically don't have, you know, randomized communities. But the ones, for example, that people are investigating now are calorie labeling. That's one, and also the effect of sort of taxes, you know, which is highly controversial, and then more recently, the effects of limits. For example, in New York City, there was a proposal to limit the sale of sugar sweetened beverages and sports drinks to no more than 16 ounces per container. That's gotten a lot of many people on the public health side think it's important first step. The data supporting that, I'm not quite sure, but it, you know, has face value, reducing calorie intake and products that most people don't really need.
You are talking today at the University of Iowa to a group that's in the medical community.
Yeah.
So I'm sure in your audience there will be doctors, there will be nurses and people who are working with patients who need to lose weight. As you've been traveling around and talking to physicians about your findings, what kind of a reaction are you getting from doctors?
You know, they like it, but they also want to be able to refer their patients to it. And right now, I mean, that's one of the things that we're working on is developing a version that would be, you know, that either health insurers, doctors, patients could use or refer patients to. You know, what we do in clinical trial, there's this step this translation step that can sometimes take time. This is not like a company that has made a pill and then they just have to ramp up production and then the pill becomes available, you know, a month or two after the results of a trial or immediately. So we're working with a company, Healthways, to develop a version of this.
Right, and
program.
Healthways is hoping to commercialize this.
Yeah.
All right. We have a number of other callers on the line. Dave is on the line from Des Moines. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Jody.
Hi, what's your question?
I'm wondering if the doctor is familiar with any research dealing specifically with visceral fat, weight gain of fat around the organs and around the waistline, which from what I've heard and read are particular culprits in many of the health problems that he's mentioned.
Yeah. That's a great question. A very crude measure of visceral fat is just what we call waist circumference, which is taking a tape and just measuring how large somebody's waist is, and sort of as close to like the pant size. We actually did measure waist circumference, and we saw a reduction in it in both groups. Again, you know, similar amounts. So I don't have the exact numbers off on top of my head, but we did publish it in our paper, and so there were significant reductions in waist circumference in this study.
Okay. Well, Dave, thank you so much for your call, and you touched a chord with Sandra, who sent us an email. She is a registered dietitian, and she says, registered licensed dietitians are educated to counsel people on diet, help them to understand how to eat, create diets appropriate for them, and work with them over time. Why don't doctors stop believing that they're the only professionals who know anything, admit that, in general, doctors know little about nutrition and how to approach it, and refer patients to those professionals who do? The same may be said about social scientists, psychologists, social workers, etc. There's plenty of help out there, but it's not recognized because physicians refuse to recognize that in some areas they're just not the experts. Well, obviously Sandra feels very passionately about this, but do you think that there has been a disconnect over the years between physicians and the dietitian community?
Yeah, I think part of the problem, though, has to do with reimbursement, and I'm very sympathetic to this. I actually served on an Institute of Medicine committee, and we did recommend coverage of nutrition counseling. I don't think physicians, they're the best people to implement behavioral lifestyle interventions. I actually believe that health coaches, they could be coaches, they could be dietitians, depending on the types of problems. So I'm actually very supportive of that. I mean, interestingly, we published the results in November, and right about the same time, I'm not sure if it was just before or just after, the Center for Medicare Services decided to reimburse physicians for delivery of weight loss services. And I said, that doesn't really make that much sense to me. I don't think that physician. I think it really the ideal people that should be reimbursed are coaches or dietitians that are actually can implement this program. So I actually agree more with her than disagree with her.
Is there a disconnect, though? I mean, is it difficult somehow for some physicians to connect with that community?
Not really. I just my sense is that, for one thing, there are probably not enough dietitians. So actually, I recall, even in our area, which has academic medical centers, it's very difficult for local physicians to find dietitians that are available to counsel patients. So I think there's a supply issue. And so that's at least in the outpatient. The inpatient setting, there actually physicians do interact pretty regularly with dietitians because there are medical issues or nutritional issues that have to be dealt with inpatients that are really extremely important and are part of routine management.
All right. Martha's on the line from Riverside. Hello, Martha.
Hi. I was wondering, did you have any vegetarians or vegans in the study?
I cannot, off the top of my head, tell you yes or no. There have been actually several studies that show that on average, those individuals who are vegetarian actually have lower weight. So I'm not sure. If there be fewer vegetarians that would qualify than non-vegetarians, I suspect.
Okay. So as you're talking to doctors, as Healthways is working to make this a commercially viable program and, you know, something that doctors and other people can really buy into, what advice would you give to a doctor today, though, if they're dealing with patients that have health problems? Is there a way that they can bring up the subject that you think might be more effective than other ways?
Yeah, I actually think there are many things that could be done. One is to just start off with that we're interested in your weight because of the health consequences. You know, so it's easier to bring up if somebody has the conditions I mentioned, type 2 diabetes or high blood pressure or high cholesterol.
Or how about if someone's pre-diabetic?
Even more so, because then you say, well, you know, I'm trying to prevent diabetes and or I'm trying to prevent the need for being placed on medications, which in some people, well, I might even get put on insulin. And you bring up insulin and people they'll be, you know, quite concerned, you know. But then what's more challenging is, besides sort of the shock value of bringing this up, is, well, what are you going to do, you know? And so what I did before the study, and actually I'm not practicing now. I'm too busy doing research. But what I typically did was say, you know, set achievable goals, as one of the earlier persons who called in. So incremental goals, 1 to 2 pounds per week. I want you to write down your goal on a calendar on a weekly basis. I want you to measure your weight, and I briefly would go over what the sources of calories were that could help them reduce their caloric intake. So sometimes it was soda. Actually, oftentimes it wasn't. They would often tell me, they would say, you know what, I eat dessert every day. So I wouldn't tell them to cut it out, but I would say, well, cut it in half or something like this. So there's some sort of concrete action. And then have them come back maybe a little bit sooner than the 3 months. But it's not going to be easy. You know, because the structure of our health outpatient healthcare delivery system is not ideally suited for accomplishing weight loss.
You mentioned that you're continuing to do other research. Were there some big questions left unanswered with this study that you are now trying to investigate or hope to investigate in the future?
there are a lot of loose ends. One is just how critical was the role of the physician, since they were just a cheerleader, and, you know, what if they were more engaged? Would you get greater weight loss? A second issue has to do with can you modify it for certain target populations? And so one of the things – we didn't have a lot of indigent people, but I think it's clear – and given the disparities in obesity and other health problems, I think gearing an intervention, you know, we focus mostly – people had to use the internet, for example, but indigent people often just use cell phones.
Right.
So sort of adapting it for that population, I think.
Well, and I can
really
see
important.
The digital divide being a problem not just with an indigent population, but with others in lower socioeconomic circumstances where they may not have access to computers as often.
Sure. So there's that population. And I'm also interested in some sort of biological issues too. So, for instance, breast cancer is individuals who are obese are at greater risk for breast cancer. And so I'm working with a group to develop a modified version for survivors of breast cancer to understand, maybe a bigger study, whether reduction in weight actually prevents recurrence of breast cancer, which I think is a really important biological issue.
Do you think issue. With our research into obesity, with the obesity epidemic and with a greater understanding of what we can do to combat obesity, do you think that our health systems will be shifting somewhat to focus more on preventative medicine?
I think they are. How far they'll go, I'm not sure. I think what is critically needed is the change in the environment that I only touched upon. So even though I had a successful clinical trial, I think we really do need to change the environment to make it the default, a healthy default, rather than an unhealthy default, which it currently is.
Dr. Lawrence Apple, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Dr. Lawrence Apple is the director of the Welch Center for Prevention, Epidemiology, and Clinical Research at Johns Hopkins University. He's visiting the University of Iowa Obesity Initiative today. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Catherine Perkins. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. Talk of Iowa is a production of IPR News.